This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And, well, Salman Rushdie needs no introduction. So we're going to get right to the conversation. Knife is out now. It is his new memoir. It is the story of August 12th, 2022, and what happened at the Chautauqua Institute in upstate New York. It is also the story of his subsequent recovery. It is also a story of the love affair he has with his wife, Eliza, and much more. And Salman, it is so good to see you. And I mean that on so many different levels.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm surprisingly okay. Surprising to myself. Also, I think pretty surprising to some of the doctors who had to inspect various pieces of my anatomy. Mm-hmm. They were all quite, with a kind of air of wonder, told me that things had healed and that mm-hmm. that they could sign off on the project of looking after me. So at this point, I don't really have doctors in my life.
And it's not quite 2 years in. You told David Remnick that you always thought your books were more interesting than your life. And of course, the world has disagreed with that. And there is so much of you in this book beyond the subject matter.
Yeah.
Beyond your marriage. How does it feel now? I mean, Knife has been out now for a week and a little bit as you and I are taping this. How does it feel to have that book in the world? How does it feel to have done all of these interviews?
Well, I'm pleased it's out there, you know. It's another part of the process of understanding what happened and also, you know, putting it behind me. I mean, I really want everybody to buy the book, so please don't think I don't want to do that. But it does feel as if something is being completed by the publication of the book. You know, some story that began, as you say, with an unpleasant attack is being brought to its conclusion by its expression in a work of art.
It is a beautiful book, Knife.
Thank you.
And you've said in the past, you know, when you're writing, you sort of convince yourself that it's a private act. Mm-hmm. And with a book like this, obviously, privacy becomes a piece of the story, and the loss of your privacy, the loss of your bodily autonomy. And to a certain extent, you lost your privacy in 1989 when people started ascribing behavior to you as you were in hiding because of the fatwa. But, you know, lots of people have had feelings about you for a really long time, and it's not necessarily been about the work.
Oh, and it's not necessarily been nice.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe to some extent, it happens to everybody mm-hmm. who gets into the public eye. That there's a kind of public persona which is not necessarily created by themselves, which is kind of created by others around them. And I think for many people in that situation, they feel the need to fight back with themselves, you know, against the selves that have been made up. And so I don't think I'm unique in that regard, but there certainly were variations of me that were floating about, many of which were quite hostile. I used to feel, I haven't felt it for a while, I used to feel that when I came into a room, so to speak, I had to work to brush aside those other selves so that people could see me.
Right.
And it sometimes took a bit of time. I actually, truthfully, in the almost 25 years that I've lived in New York City, I really haven't felt that much anymore. I think people got used to having me around.
We definitely do. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've seen you bopping around at things, and it's just, oh, hello. Hi. It's nice to see you.
It's one of the nice things about New York is that people recognize that you're around, and then they mm-hmm. kind of respectful of your space, you know? And so I felt actually much less oppressed by those other selves. But of course, one of the most dangerous of the other selves is the other self that was created in the world of Islamic radicalism, where I was described as being somebody worth killing. And that I also thought had begun to fade away. And in the mind of this young man, obviously it had not.
I think I'm not alone in saying that we were all shocked when the news came out in August, and now also having seen footage and photographs from the event. I was a baby bookseller when the Satanic versus paperback was, shall we say, delayed. And then it finally was released, and we had stacks and stacks and stacks and displays in the store that I was working in. And plenty of people came around, and I mean, lots of stores took it. It wasn't just the store that I was at. Technically, the fatwa was lifted in 1998 in some circles, and then yet not in others. So the idea that this kid, who was not even alive on the planet, he's 24.
Yeah.
Was not even on the planet when Khomeini declared the fatwa. I think there's a larger conversation we need to have about radicalism and young people.
Yeah, I mean, he was clearly somebody. I do believe that there are people whose character is such that they're looking to be led. You know, they're looking to for something, some idea to subscribe to, you know, and maybe because I don't want to be too judgmental because I don't know the man, maybe because of some kind of absences in their life that they feel the need to fill those absences with something which feels like purpose, you know, and ideology can do that. He has said, I mean, I've seen only, he gave one slightly unwise interview to the New York Post. Mm-hmm. He did talk about his admiration for Khomeini.
Yeah.
So there's that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that there's a kind of question mark in him about why would somebody want to murder somebody who was an almost total stranger to them, about whom they knew almost nothing, knowing that it would also deeply affect their own life.
Mm.
You know, that the life of a non-criminal young man living in New Jersey is very different from the life of a lifer jailbird. But he must have known that that was probably going to be his future. And yet he was prepared to do it.
And he hadn't read a single page of the Satanic Verses. He hasn't read a single page of any of your books, actually. And there are 22 now.
Yeah, I know. So with a lot of pages in them.
Well, Jaguar Smile, not so much.
Not so much. A knife, not much, actually.
But you do ask in the book whose face he saw. I mean, for 27 seconds. The attack takes 27 seconds, which when you say the words out loud does not sound like a lot of time.
No.
But I was walking around my home timing 27, and it feels like forever.
It's a very long time if you just put a stopwatch on your phone and wait. And if in those 27 seconds you are defenseless against somebody with a knife, there's a lot of damage that can be done. And I mean, I had to, at the time I wasn't counting, but afterwards I did count, and I think the number of serious injuries is 15.
Right.
Not all of them are lethal injuries, but some of them are obviously near lethal. Because some of them are stab wounds, and those are the dangerous things, and some of them are just slashes. You know, where I mean, for example, there was a big cut like here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, as you see, gone away. That's healed. But the big wounds is there was an enormous slash across my neck, which by some extraordinary piece of good fortune failed to rupture the artery. And there was a stab wound in my neck on the right side. Those were very serious. Obviously, the wound in the eye is very serious. And then there were three stab wounds down the center of my chest, which, again, fortunately, missed the heart. So there are things which could have ended the story right then, you know, which didn't happen. And my son, Milan, who, being 26, does what 26-year-old kids do, which is he Googled knife attack. And he said to me, he said, "Dad, you know, I'm reading all these things, and people get stabbed once and they die. And you got stabbed 15 times and you're still okay." So this is my superpower.
Well, it's a nice superpower. Let's hold on to it, please. But let's also not have any more attacks, more importantly.
Yeah, no, I'm good to that.
But one of the doctors also said to you, you were very lucky that you were attacked by a man who actually didn't know how to kill another person with a knife.
Yeah, I think that's what they felt, because he failed to do this actually quite simple things, which would have ended the story. Lucky me.
Lucky you. I don't think people are going to expect the humor that we get in Knife if they are not familiar with your novels. I am going to mention Fran Lebowitz. At this point, she's a writer I'm quite fond of, and you were having a conversation with her after the fact. You thought you'd actually been punched in the face at first. You were not clear on what was happening.
Yes, I thought I'd been hit very hard on my jaw on the right side. I didn't know there was a knife in his fist. Then there were a lot of other things. And Fran said, because I put up my hand to defend myself, she said, "You're right-handed, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "But you put up your left hand. Why do you do that?" And my truthful answer was, you know, Fran, I wasn't really thinking about it. But then I said, maybe it's like a boxing thing, that if you're right-handed, you put up your left hand to defend and your right hand to punch. And she said, "Yeah, Salman, but two things." Said, in the first place, you're not a boxer.
Sorry.
And in the second place, you weren't doing any punching.
And if you can imagine this in Fran Lebowitz's very matter-of-fact voice,
yeah,
saying to you, really, no. And you bring your life into this book in a way that, you know, I went back to Joseph Anton as I was prepping for this conversation and reread Joseph Anton, and that was your memoir of the years. It was 9 years?
9 years, yeah.
Yeah, 9 years, basically, from the publication of Satanic through, and some of your background as well, some of your childhood and your schooling, yeah, and whatnot. And it's written in the third person, and it's a very elegant way of telling the story, and it's a really great device. You get quite a lot. It's also about 600 pages, am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, longest book I ever wrote.
Okay. It doesn't feel like 600 pages, but yes, it takes a minute. But the difference between that and Knife isn't, to me, just the circumstances of the book's creation, but also what you're doing with the art.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you know, Joseph Anton takes place over an extended period of time and goes back, as you say, even further than that into childhood and so on. This is a very intense, narrow spectrum book by comparison. And the other thing is that at the point at which I wrote Joseph Anton, it was quite a long time after the events being described in the book. And what I felt is that there was a gap between the me writing the book and the me being written about. The me being written about had been in an entirely different place in his life, much more stressful, much more, you know, much more difficult place and under all sorts of stress, whereas the me writing the book was in a much better place and a much calmer place. And so I thought there's this gap, and using the third person was a way of expressing that gap, you know, and saying I'm writing about a person with my name, but who isn't quite me. It used to be me, isn't quite me now. Whereas in this book, Knife, there's no distance at all. No distance at all between the person writing the book and the person being written about. And so I thought there has to be first person.
You are also needing to rely, though, on your wife's notes and some film that she took of you and photographs and your family members and doctors and whatnot, because you were on a ventilator.
Yeah.
There were lots of conversations in lots of corners of New York where people were deeply concerned. And not having any information too, you know, people's imaginations go where they go. But for you to come back, especially for the footage, and you talk about a documentary film that will be coming at some point,
mm-hmm,
but you sound so detached when you're talking about what must have been an extraordinary set of, shall we say, notes from other people about, I mean, Eliza wouldn't let you look in a mirror.
No, not for weeks. I mean, look, the thing is, there was a period, the first couple of days, it was not clear that I would survive.
Okay.
The doctors had said that to Eliza, that, you know, the first couple of days will tell whether he will be able to, you know, for example, whether he'll be able to come off the ventilator.
Okay.
And that was the first big question mark. Would I be able to breathe, you know, unaided? I didn't know any of this. You know, I was in a very heavily medicated state. I was on extremely exciting painkillers. And they were giving me hallucinations. And so I was not in my perfect mind, to quote Shakespeare. That's Lear, isn't it? But around me, there was obviously an enormous amount of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this moment of the ventilator being removed, I experienced, first of all, it's not very pleasant. I mean, it's not to be recommended, mm-hmm. the whole business of having a ventilator. But the moment it came out, my feeling was of joy because I could speak. You know, and I think the first thing I said was, I can speak. To me, it felt like a huge moment and a very optimistic moment.
You know? Mm-hmm.
I think some of the doctors were still pretty kind of reserved. Let's see how this goes.
Right. You know?
But it went all right. Then it turned out that I was able to breathe by myself.
When I was reading the sections where you're recounting your hallucinations, because they were cities built out of words and the alphabet,
yeah,
I started thinking about Victory City, which came out in paperback earlier, about 3 months ago, actually, which was your novel from February of 23, and you had just finished proofing the last set of galleys before basically the last set of changes before you went to galley, and the book came out in hardcover in February of 23. And obviously you were not in a position to do anything. There was an interview with David Remnick, but beyond that, there was not a tour or anything else.
Couldn't do anything.
I love Victory City. I love Pampa. I love this world. But the idea, you know, if for folks who have not read Victory City yet, please go do. Especially if Midnight's Children is a novel that you hold close. This is a book you need to read. But Pampa, who is sort of the main, she's the heart and soul of this book. Mm-hmm. She blows on some seeds and a world is created.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to spoil it. So I'm going to sort of leave it at that for the moment. But I really just thought, oh, you know, Solomon talks about the free association of his brain. And you've done it in many, many places. You will talk about, you know, I go from movies to music to books to everything else. I'm a little more linear. I tend to go straight to books. But Victory City obviously was completed before all of this happened. And there have been some people who said, oh, no, well, look at this overlap and look at that overlap. And I'm thinking, well, no, the book was actually finished before all of this happened.
It was finished and I didn't change anything.
But Victory City, you've talked about you're trained as a historian. You know, your college experience was history. Midnight's Children is a surreal novel, but it's a history novel.
Yes, it is.
And I feel that way about Victory City. And can we just talk about the creation of that book?
Yeah.
Because Pampa is one of my favorite characters of yours.
Mine too, actually.
She's amazing.
She might be my favorite character of mine, but she's certainly top three.
Okay.
Anyway, yes, what had happened was when I was very young, before I'd published any kind of a novel,
mm-hmm.
and in my early 20s, I was traveling in India, in South India. And the thing about me and my family is that we're very much North Indian. So South India is a different world, you know, and different languages, different histories, very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited this in the state of Karnataka in South India. There's this small town called Hampi. And near or around Hampi are the ruins of what used to be the Vijayanagara Empire. Vijayanagara is a word which means victory city. Vijaya, victory, Nagar, city. I was just stunned by these ruins. They were so spectacular. And I thought, you know, I'm an Indian person growing up in India. Why don't I know anything about this? And actually, it continues to be surprising to me how under-noticed that place is, even though the empire ruled the whole of South India, which is half the country, for a couple of hundred years, and was basically entering its phase of decline at the moment when in North India the Mughal Empire was rising, the much better known Mughal Empire.
Yep.
And you know, for every 1,000 people that visit the Taj Mahal, there's probably one person who visits Hampi. And so I felt like this unknown treasure. Mm-hmm. And I made lots and lots of notes and took pictures. I mean, I was not even 24, I think I was, you know, hadn't written a book. Mm-hmm. But I filed it away somewhere deep in my head. And then later, when I was writing The Enchantress of Florence, a lot of which does take place in the Mughal Empire, I remember thinking, yeah, but there was that other place in the south. And that was pretty amazing too. And maybe at some point you've got to think about that. And what I now think is that these two books, The Enchantress of Florence and Victory City, if you put them together, they're a kind of history novel about India. And they say, this is where we came from. You know, this is who we were. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, this is who we still are. I just fell in love with the story of Vijayanagara. And then I had to ask myself some technical questions, like how do you write a book that lasts for 2.5 centuries? Mm-hmm. You know, unless you want to write a Tolstoyan,
right,
2,000-page book, which I really didn't. How do you hold together a book that lasts for that long? And also, there is a problem about the history being that old. Back in the, you know, it's mid 14th century is the beginning of. When you're that long ago, the historical record is imperfect. There are holes in it. And there are things which are presented as history, which you can see are actually much more like legend, you know, than history, which is good for a novelist. It leaves you space. But one of the things that puzzled me was, if you look at the history of that period, if you look even like 15 or 20 years before the birth of the Vijayanagara Empire, there are all these other kingdoms doing perfectly well. And then suddenly out of nowhere comes this thing, boom, and takes over everything. How does that happen? How does something come out of nowhere? And the answer to these both questions was Pampa Kampana. I thought, first of all, okay, I'm going to have a woman touched by a goddess who lives for 2.5 centuries. And it's her story. And she's going to tell the story, but it's also going to be the story of her.
It's also a book about a book.
Yes, because she's writing the book of which my book is a pale imitation.
I like the structure. I like the way you've inserted some notes. There are some very funny asides where it's just very you.
It's a little bit like thinking of Nabokov in Pale Fire.
Yeah.
The way in which there are kind of footnotes.
No, I do like the structure. I really like the voices. I like her sort of wry sensibility. But also when I'm reading you, and this is true of so many of the books, that we can't just have the good stuff or just all of the bad stuff. You do this tragic comedy thing in a way that I will basically follow you anywhere, because the balance, no, really, I've been reading you for a very long time. The balance and the way you do it and the way I can pick up something like Shame or Fury years later, and they still speak to this moment, right? Especially, I mean, Fury was published on 9/11, 2001.
Extraordinary. Yeah.
Right? And so it was a little lost in the news cycle, shall we say. And you've had moments of saying, well, that was the moment it became a piece of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And yet here we are in 2024, and I'm not particularly a fan of nostalgia. I think it's great as a literary device, but human desire for nostalgia doesn't always work for me.
Quite right.
To look at it now and hold it and reread it, you know, 20 some odd years after publication, you still hit every single piece of New York in that moment, and some of that stuff is resurfacing. Everything is cyclical.
I just felt that was when I had just come to live in New York City. So it was like the city making its first. I mean, I'd visited many, many times, but it's different when you're living there. To live somewhere is not the same as visiting. Mm-hmm. However, I mean, I felt I knew New York quite well because I'd been,
mm-hmm.
And I had friends all over the place, and I didn't feel like a stranger in town, you know?
Right.
But living somewhere is different. And what I felt is that the city was at an extraordinary moment of self-confidence, maybe even overconfidence, and wealth,
mm-hmm.
and arrogance, you know, and telling itself that well-known myth, which is the myth of the Golden Age. And one of the things you know if you're trained as a historian, first of all, there ain't no such thing.
Right.
And secondly, when people believe that it is, as for example, Paris in the Beaux-Arts period, for example, doesn't last very long. It's always a brief moment which feels, during its brief moment, it feels eternal. And the people right. in it think, okay, this is forever. This is who we now are. But you always know there's going to be an ending. And so I had that feeling about New York City in the year 2000. I thought, I want to just try and capture this before it goes away. It's like Nabokov chasing butterflies, you know, capture it before it goes away. And then, to my shock, it went away on the day the book was published.
Right.
That New York, the New York that I had been writing about, went away and another city came into being.
And yet somehow we've sort of flipped back on that earlier incarnation. New York sort of, it's haunted by its earlier incarnations and they keep rolling back up.
Yeah.
And it just takes a minute to do it. But Victory City, you're doing a similar thing with this idea of the Golden Age as well. And the fact that we can tell ourselves stories.
Because it's over such a long period, Victory City. It has Golden Ages and then Dark Ages and then another bit of a Golden Age and then another Dark Age. And that feels to me like the truth, you know. That's how history goes. It changes all the time. It doesn't run on tram lines, you know. It has unexpected changes of direction. I wanted to write a novel which isn't just a historical novel, but a novel about history.
Midnight's Children isn't just the creation of India as we know it. It's also, I mean, if I think about Salim and handcuffed to history. And you've said this before, like, does our history make us? Does it unmake us? Are we, how do we sit with history? And I look at the body of your work. And if we go, I'm going to take Grimus out of the equation for a second, because that's your first novel. And it's a first novel. It's a debut. So we're going to take Grimus out. But if we start with Midnight's Children, which I do really think of as the book that kicks off everything, because when you look at how Victory City comes back into conversation with Midnight's Children, or Keyshot, which came out in 2020, just as the world was going in a different direction. And Keyshot, too, though, captures a New York and an America in a moment. I mean, yes, it's a playoff of Don Quixote, but it's very you.
Yeah, it's not just Don Quixote. It's also Candide of Voltaire.
Yeah.
I mean, what I was trying to do in that book was to use almost every literary technique that exists in the same book to throw it at the subject of America and see what stuck, you know. I think parts of it are surrealist, parts of it are absurdist, parts of it are quite realistic. You know? And I just thought, have a character, I mean, in the way that Voltaire does in Candide, have a character who is ludicrously optimistic and throw him against a world which has no reason for optimism. And that becomes comedy and tragedy at the same time. And also because I am accused by people who know me of that fault of excessive optimism.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, let me just exaggerate that. Make the character Keyshot like a satire of myself, if you like.
Right.
And so it becomes me as the Picaro traveling across. I mean, actually, in the end, it is like a picaresque novel. It's episodic.
I never get tired of that book. I've read it a couple of times now. And I'm just, every time there's a new layer or there's a detail, there's a sibling relationship in there that is really satisfying. There are just some wild laugh out loud moments. It is very much America in a moment. It's also dedicated to your wife, Eliza.
Yeah.
And you met at the end of 16 when you walked through into a plate glass door. I'm sorry. You put the story in Knife.
Early 2017, actually.
Okay, early 2017.
But yeah, there was a pen event that we were both on the same program at the Cooper Union. And immediately after the event, there was an after party on the roof terrace of the Standard Hotel on the Bowery. And as you know, that's got an inside and an outside, and there's like boards in between. And I thought, it's a lovely summer evening. Let's go out and look at the city at night. And she went ahead of me, and I was following her. I was a little distracted. And what I didn't notice was that the sliding door on my side was not open. It was shut. And, you know, if you walk through a space where you think it's an empty space, mm-hmm. but it's not, you actually hit it very hard.
Yes.
And that's what I did. I fell down. My glasses cut the bridge of my nose, so there was a little bit of blood trickling down my face. Then there were all these people gathering around, going, oh, my God, Salman Rushdie's fallen down. And panic, panic. All I was telling myself is, do not faint. Do not pass out.
Right.
And then I got up and I was sort of all right. I was a bit shaken. I was mostly embarrassed. And I thought, you know, I'm really embarrassed. I think I'm also a bit shaky. I think maybe I should go.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, I think I'm going to get a taxi and go home. And she came down with me because she's worried about my worriedness, just to make sure I was okay getting into the taxi. And then we were saying goodbye. And then she said, you know, I'm just going to come with you to make sure you're okay until you get home. Mm-hmm. So she got in the taxi. Rest is history.
This is also where I'm going to point out that you include that story in Knife. And, you know, some other writers might have left out the I walked into a glass door at full force and landed on the floor. Some people might have left that out.
I can't leave it out because she enjoys telling the story too much.
Okay, well, that's fair. But there's a sense of play in Quichotte that I wouldn't say is missing from other books. It's just, it's a different experience. And I'm wondering how much of that is your relationship with Eliza, which was still pretty new at that point. I mean, the book came out in 2020, so you were writing it, what, over 17, 18? You're pretty quick when you're...
Yeah, I mean, I got quicker of late, you know. I mean, the last several books have come out almost at two-year intervals.
And yeah.
2.5-year intervals, which is unusual for me. I mean, I used to be much slower. I don't know if that is an improvement or not, but anyway, that's how it is. And yeah, I mean, I think it was a lot to do with happiness, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you feel in a really good place in your personal life, it liberates something in the imagination and in your working space. Mm-hmm. You know, it just means there's something not weighing you down.
Mm-hmm.
Not being happy does.
Right.
But there are writers who'd make wonderful careers out of not being happy.
I read them too. Part of why I raise that, though, is Knife is also very much a love story between you and Eliza, and it's gorgeous to read. She's a novelist and a poet and a photographer and a videographer and essentially an artist in her own right. But I'm wondering, too, when I think about how you write about love in most of your books, but especially Quichotte, are you a romantic?
Yeah.
I mean, do you meet the technical definition? And I don't mean in the terms of like romance novels. I mean in the genuine sense of the word.
Yeah, believing in love.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. Although I had almost stopped, you know.
Okay.
And my previous marriage ended in divorce. Now, I mean, it's almost 17 years ago. And so at the time that I met Eliza, it was more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Since I hadn't been married, you know. And for a lot of that decade, I hadn't actually really been with anyone. There'd been odd moments of relationships, but I hadn't continuously been with anyone. And I remember discussing it with my sister, who's a year younger than me, who's also on her own now. And we thought, maybe that's over, you know. Maybe that part of life is over. And we just have to accept the fact that we're going to be these old people on their own. And I remember saying to her, you know, I think that's okay. Because a lot of life is fine, you know. I mean, I have work that I love, and I have family that I love, and friends that I love, and nice place to live, and kind of enough money, and nothing wrong with this picture, you know. Doesn't need somebody to step into it in order to complete the picture. And both of us agreed that, yeah, it was kind of all right. If that's how it was going to be, that would be okay. And then, I mean, one of my theories about love has been it always comes up behind you and whacks you on the back of the head.
Or smack in the face if you walk into a door.
But it never comes in the direction you're looking.
Right.
It comes from some unexpected angle. Mm-hmm. And so at that moment of meeting Eliza, I was actively not looking for romance.
Right.
You know, I'd sort of made a decision with myself. But it's all right. My life is fine. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't even thinking about it. Then it came up and whacked me behind the head.
One of the bits of knife that I'm very appreciative of is when you're talking about the recovery process too, you're talking about very conscious choices on your part to not just survive, but to heal in whatever way that means, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're very clear, you knew you were dying. You knew you were dying. You were terribly lonely as this was happening. And once the recovery process starts, and it's quite harrowing, the recovery process, but you have your sons, you have Eliza, you have your brain and the way it works. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you were leaving not a lot out. I mean, we've learned all sorts of things about medical miracles, but watching you on the page, and I mean the Salman Rushdie that you present to us on the page, I'm going to operate off of the fact that there's still a private Salman.
Somewhere.
That you haven't given us everything, right? That there is.
Not much left, I have to tell you.
Okay. But now, the writing process has to look different for you. I mean, a novel is one thing to begin with. Mm-hmm. A memoir like Joseph Anton is still more novelistic than not.
Yes.
And now we have Knife, which, as metaphor, Knife as profile of you. I mean, how has this changed you as a writer?
Well, I mean, one of the things to be, how shall I put this? I'm always trying to look for a thing I haven't done.
Okay.
And instead of just simply writing another book like the last book, I'm always trying to think, where can I go that I haven't been, you know, as a writer? And I mean, for terrible reasons, this book propelled me into I'm not just talking about my physical self, I'm talking about my writing self. It propelled me into a place I'd never been. This forced me to ask questions of myself and face literary challenges different from anything I'd written before. And so in that way, paradoxically, it's quite satisfying, because it did fulfill my desire to find books that I haven't written before. You know, and this is certainly a book I hope I never have to write again.
Yes, no sequels to this one, please.
No.
Midnight's Children is a book that I have walked around with stamped on my DNA for quite some time. I was very, very young the first time I read it, and it's a book that I've gone back to a couple of times, both on the page and as an audiobook. And if you were an audiobook person, highly recommend. It's really good.
I think it's very well done. I think, it's not done by me, but it's very well.
But whoever they found understands what you're trying to do with the language too, because one of the things I needed from Midnight's Children, I needed to have something that felt fresh and alive and not... You have a different relationship to Passage to India than I do in the E.M. Forrester novel, and I probably should revisit it as an adult. I have not read it in quite some time. But I mean, Forrester is a man of his time and his language is of his time. And I just, I needed that bounce and that kinetic energy and that life that you get when you read Midnight's Children. And it's a page turner, but it's a literary novel. I mean, stuff happens.
You know, I was lucky that I met Forster. I was at King's College, Cambridge, and he was in residence there. He was an honorary. He was 91. I was 19.
Wow.
And we had two or three small meetings in which, because of his interest in India, interested in me as having of Indian origin. And I mean, he was a very, very nice and actually very modest man. But I thought, like, okay, I kind of touched the hem of his garment, you know. But what I felt is that Forsterian English doesn't sound like the place that I knew. You know, the place that I knew was hot and noisy and loud and everything at once and too much. I thought, how do you make that English? How do you make an English that feels like that? A kind of opposite of Forsterian is very cool and English. I thought, I want an English that doesn't feel English. And that's what was the effort of Midnight's Children, is to find that language. And some of it comes out of street language. Some of it just comes out of the way I remember people speaking around me as I was growing up.
Right.
Finding a literary version of that, a written down version of that. But I'm, you know, it changed my life, that book. It gave me the ability to live as a writer. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, made my name. So I have very fond feelings of it.
But I love the fact, too, that you turned to Philip Roth for inspiration for that book, his mix of Yiddish and English and his work. And you were just like, well, if he can do it. And Joseph Heller, Catch 22, and Gunter Grass and the Tin Drum, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez with 100 Years of Solitude. The idea that you were pulling from global traditions to create this thing that is so wildly you and so wildly India. And, you know, unfortunately, it is slightly dated. If you look at where India is going now, it doesn't feel like it quite sings with possibility the way it did.
When it came out, I mean, it was wonderfully well received.
Yeah.
And if there was a criticism of it, one or two people made it, they said that the ending felt too pessimistic.
Huh.
I think if you compare what actually happened to Midnight's Children, the ending feels absurdly optimistic.
Yeah.
So that's what history does to texts, you know, it changes them. But yeah, and I mean, I've been asked, I don't know how many times, if I would ever write a sequel to it.
Hmm.
But I think, you know, no. I mean, I'm not, you know, Charles Dickens always had a desire to know what happened to his characters after the end of the story. Mm-hmm. You know? And he would often write like postscripts in which he told you
right. What
happened to everybody, including the pets, you know.
True.
And I don't have that. I think once I've finished a book, I have no further knowledge of those characters and actually no further interest. In those characters.
All of that makes sense to me because Midnight's Children, it's an entire world between two jackets, right? Like, that's why I read. I read because I need to touch things that aren't just down the street from me. But you have recently said that it's Midnight's Children is a young man's book and you don't particularly write like that anymore. And I was wondering what you meant because I feel like that energy is still, especially in the newer novels like Victory City and Quichotte, that it's there.
Yeah, I mean, it's harder to get. That's what it is.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, I don't think I've got another 600-page book in me.
Okay.
I mean, the version of Midnight Children you've got is, I mean, it was longer.
Oh.
I mean, it was longer before I submitted it. I cut stuff out. And interestingly, some of the excised material is now in my archives are at Emory University. And I remember going to look at the box with the manuscripts of Midnight's Children. And I saw all these pages which were crossed out, you know, I mean, quite a lot, that at some point I had just drawn a line through them. And I started looking at them. I thought, what's wrong with this? This is pretty good. And so there actually is material there, which I don't know, maybe I was wrong to cut it, but too late now.
I don't know. Could we do an annotated by your hand version? Well, I don't think Random House would disagree.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of these days when I have a minute, I would like to actually go back into the Emory archive and and sit with all that material. I mean, they have the manuscript of Midnight's Children, but they also have all this other stuff of earlier material. And as I say, all these pages crossed out. And I wouldn't mind having a real careful look through those. There might be some stuff there.
I would really like you to have a look through that manuscript also, because one of the things I was looking at as I was prepping for this conversation is Abdul Razak Gurna edited a Cambridge University companion to you. And did I read it? Yes, I did, because I love that man. And I was just like, you know what? I just want to see what all of this is about. And it was kind of fun to approach your work from a purely academic standpoint. I had never...
Very nice. So he did it completely off his own bat, you know. And you know, went on to win the Nobel Prize. So it's I'm very happy that he did it. And I'm very happy that it exists.
It's a very fun read when you're doing homework. And I love the idea that you're canon. Your work is canon now.
Is it? Yeah.
Yes, you are canon. You were taught in lots and lots of places. And I love the idea that you're the one who's, you know, you got tapped.
I don't know. It's what, you know, if you're my kind of writer, you want to write books that will endure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for me, that was always an enormous part of it, because the books that I love, many of them are books that have endured. You know? I mean, I've got past the point of reading to keep up. You know, I don't read this year's big thing. I did read The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, and it's fantastic. But I'm more likely to be reading Madame Bovary, you know, or Kafka than this year's big book. And all those books have in common that they endured. And it struck me that the only reason books endure is that people love them. It's the only reason. You know, whatever else, scandal, anything, that all goes away. The survival of a book is always driven by the people who love it. You know? And I thought if that happens to one or two of my books, I won't be around to see it, but my ghost will be very happy.
And there's some younger readers like me who've grown up with you, so we're pretty excited that they're sticking around as well.
Well, I love it. But, you know, Midnight's Children is what? It's 40-odd years old and still finds readers. I feel very happy about that, because that means it's already gone into maybe two generations, at least, onwards. So it's got a shot.
Well, I mean, you've said this multiple times as well, but, you know, not only does art challenge orthodoxy, art is not a luxury. And I think books are kind of the ultimate example of that.
I would absolutely agree. And I think, you know, when I was working in advertising, there was a campaign, I remember, for a manufacturer of glass. And imagine life without glass. And it just showed photographs of the world with all the glass removed. And it looked like jail. And I thought, well, imagine life without art. Imagine life with no music, with no pictures, with no stories. What would that be like? And I think if you think about it like that, you realize that whether we know it or not, consciously or not, we all consume art at some level every day. And it's really an important part of how we are in the world. And also, it tells us the story of ourselves. And that's what literature does better than anything else.
And that seems like the perfect place to end this conversation. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for joining us on Poured Over. Knife is out now. Obviously, there is a delightful backlist, but Keyshot and Victory City are definitely out in paperback. Midnight's Children, if somehow you have not, highly, highly recommend it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I really have enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.